The Shmuz was composed and recorded L'Zeichen Nishmas Rav Yosef Kalta Zechron Levrocha, Reb Yosef Ben Yabadul Chaim, Rav Naftali Shimon HaKohen.
Throughout the 40 years that the Jewish people lived in the Midbar, their source of water was the Be'er. The Be'er was a very large boulder that traveled with them wherever they went, and this boulder provided them with all of the water that they needed, all the water that they needed for their drinking purposes, all the water they needed for cleaning, and this was a nes nigla, a very clear, overt, and obvious miracle. Towards the end of the stay of the Jewish people in the Midbar, Miriam dies, and the rock that had been with them all this time left. It went amongst all the other rocks, it couldn't be found, and the water dried up. The Klal Yisrael came to Moshe Rabbeinu and to Aaron, and they said, "Why have you brought us here to die? We and our all of our animals were going to die of thirst." So Hashem appears to Moshe and to Aaron, and Hashem tells Moshe, "Take the staff and go speak to the rock. Go out, speak to the rock, and from that rock will again come water." Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron go out, and Rashi explains that first Moshe Rabbeinu did exactly as told. He spoke to the rock, but he couldn't identify the rock. He didn't know which one it was. It had hidden amongst many of the other rocks. He spoke to it, and nothing happened. At that point, Moshe Rabbeinu hit the rock once. Some drops of water began coming out. He hit the rock a second time, and a full force flow of water came out. And in fact, all of the Jewish people were able to again drink. And again, they had that Be'er for many years until they actually left the Midbar. And the Pasuk tells us that Hashem had a major complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu. Yan lohim mantim bi, you and Aaron, you didn't believe in me, lakdisheni, to make a Kiddush Hashem. Says Rashi, what Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu is, there was a major compromise in what the intended plan was. Hashem says, I asked you to speak to the rock. Had you spoken to the rock, the Jewish nation would have made a Kal Vachomer. They would have said, oh my goodness, look at this. An inanimate object, a rock that doesn't need Hashem for its sustenance. It exists as it is, yet it listens to the word of Hashem. Surely we who are dependent on Hashem, surely we should listen to the words of Hashem. Had Moshe Rabbeinu spoken to the rock and the rock would have given forth that water, and that's the Kal Vachomer the Jewish people would have made. However, because Moshe Rabbeinu hit the rock, as a result, that Kal Vachomer was lost. That great lesson the Jewish people could have learned was lost. And therefore, Rashi explains, because of this sin, Moshe and Aaron were not allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael. And this is the Rashi. And if you think about this Rashi, it is very, very difficult to understand. Let's think about this for a moment. If you have ever taken a dive into a pool of water, you very clearly understand that there's a difference between rock and water. Water is something that's clear, and water is something that flows, and water is something that you dive into and you swim in. Rock is a very different substance. Rock is hard. Rock is very dense. For a rock to suddenly spew forth water is a miracle of unimaginable proportions. What difference does it make? Oh, Moshe, had you spoken to the rock and it would have given off water, that would have been a miracle. Then the Jewish nation would have learned a great lesson. But Nebuch, you didn't do that. You hit the rock. And because you hit the rock and the water came out, that was lost. Whether you speak to a rock, whether you hit a rock, for water to come out of a rock is remarkably miraculous. You can't squeeze a rock and expect the moisture that's contained within it to come out as a trickle or a flow, and certainly not a real force of water that's going to feed people. There was a U.S. quartermaster. His job is to feed the troops. Logistics of the army is largely what keeps the success or the failure in war. The quartermaster's job it is to make sure that there's enough rations, to make sure that there's enough food and beverage for the troops. A U.S. quartermaster once estimated, based on the average consumption, how much water would it take to keep the Jewish people alive in that midbar, in the desert? So, assuming we have 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60, you add the women, it's 1.2 million, add the children under 20, add the adults over 60, approximately 3 million people. He estimated that it would take at least 11 million gallons of water a day to keep the people alive. Each person needs about a gallon of water to drink. You need water to clean yourself. You also need plenty and plenty of water for the many animals that they had. They had herds, sheep, goats, cows. They had huge amounts of livestock with them. The amount of water would be an astonishing amount. But the truth is that he greatly, greatly underestimated the real amount. Because the Medrash explains to us that many years earlier, the first time when, in fact, Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to hit the rock, first all the heads of the Shevatim, each Shevet sent its head, and each of them stood by this rock, and each of them drew a line with their staff towards their Shevet. And then when Moshe Rabbeinu hit the rock began spewing forth water. But not just a trickle and not just a little bit of water. It began spewing forth so much water that it filled up a huge flow. To each Shevet where it stood, where it was encamped, came a tremendous flow of water. Remember that in the Midbar, the Jewish nation were encamped with the Mishkan in the center and the 12 tribes around surrounding it, Shevet Levi right near the Mishkan. But it was a very, very large encampment. And to contain that many people takes a huge, huge area. And the flow of water went to each Shevet. But it wasn't merely a tributary. It wasn't just a flow of water like a channel being filled up. And there was an abundance of water. There was so much water that bushes and trees grew along the riverbanks of what this flow was. As a matter of fact, the Medrash tells us that from certain parts of the encampment to the other, you needed to cross with a boat. There was so much water. There was so much water flowing from this rock that you literally had to cross the channel on a boat because that's how deep, that's how thick it was. We're not talking about a few million gallons a day. We're talking about millions and millions, hundreds of millions. Hard to even imagine how much water was coming from this rock. So let's ask the question. Well, Moshe Rabbeinu, had you spoken to the rock, that would have been a miracle. The Jewish nation would have learned his lesson. But you hit the rock. Whether you speak to the rock, whether you hit the rock, for this rock to spew forth water is such a miracle it's hard to imagine. And keep in mind that the encampment of the Jewish people moved. From time to time, the Anan would leave from over Shevet Yehuda, the shofars would be blown, and the entire Jewish nation would march. And this rock followed them. To have a rock that follows you in the desert, that spew forth enough water to fill literally channels and channels are so wide you need a boat to go across, is a miracle. I don't care how you slice it. And if you don't yet hear this question, let's focus on one last step. A gallon of water weighs about 8 pounds. What that means is a million gallons of water weighs about 8 million pounds. 11 million gallons would weigh about 88 million pounds. And if you have this huge channel, this lake, and that you're crossing with a boat, we're talking about hundreds of millions, billions of pounds of water. So let's imagine you have a large boulder. Let's say this bear is a very big rock. It weighs 1 million pounds, 14 million, 144 million pounds, whatever it weighs. Here's the question. It spews forth water day after day after day. If there's water in this rock, so after a day, whatever water is gone. If it spews forth a billion pounds of stuff a day, eventually the rock withers, it's just not there anymore. How could this rock, which is a finite amount of material, spew forth what seems to be an infinite amount of water on and on and on? Clearly, it's a miracle. So the question on this Rashi is rather obvious. Why does Rashi say that Hashem says to Moshe, had you spoken to the rock, then the Jewish nation would have learned a great lesson. But unfortunately, you didn't, and that lesson's learned. The lesson is there, whether you hit the rock or you spoke to the rock. What does Rashi mean? And I'd like to see if we can understand this, and I believe from this Rashi we can learn a tremendous life lesson. And to do that, let's begin with the following. The Rambam tells us that the most assured, guaranteed way to love Hashem is to study the Bria. He explains, look out at the world, its complexity, its vastness. Look up at the sky, and immediately you'll be filled with an awe, with a sense of appreciation, with a tremendous sense of love. If this is the creation, what does it tell me about my creator? And immediately, says Rambam, you'll be filled with a desire to know this creator as much as you can, and to study him and you'll be filled with the love of this Creator. With that being said, I'd like to ask a very obvious question. Never in the course of history has there been this much information available to the common man. School children today understand science, technology, the physical world in a way that great men of 500 years ago couldn't even imagine. We live in a world of information overload. There's so much knowledge. There's so much out there without even opening Wikipedia. And the average person knows so much about the physical world. Wouldn't you imagine that we'd all be the highest level of maminim? Meaning, I'm not asking why is it that an atheist, a person who doesn't want to believe, doesn't believe. I'm asking about you and me. We know these things. We've studied biology. We've studied chemistry. On some level, we're very aware of the fantastic systems in this world. If the Rambam says the most assured way to come to love Hashem is to study this world, we've all studied this world phenomenally more than people have ever done before. Why then aren't we the biggest believers in the world? And why aren't we always sitting there saying, Hashem, wow, this is astonishing? And I think the answer to this question underscores much of what belief really is predicated on. And from understanding this, we'll understand a tremendous lesson. Let's begin with one important concept. In previous Shmuzim, I've discussed the fact that there are four levels to basic emunah. The first level of emunah is knowing that Hashem created the world. Now, most of us take a very cavalier, of course, and know that Hashem created the world. That's obvious. I don't have to work on that one. That's a given. I'm not a kofer. And I'd like to share with you that the first level of emunah is not simple at all. How do I know that? Because 1/7 of your life, 1/7 of your life is dedicated to getting that concept. Shabbos is Zeich L'Maaseh Bereishis. We stop from creative acts on Shabbos. The Achronim explained the acts that the Torah forbade, the malachas, are all creative acts. They're acts that man shows his dominance, his control over nature. We stop demonstrating our control over nature to understand this one concept. Hashem is the creator and we are his creations. We disengage from creative acts on Shabbos so that we learn this key concept that the world wasn't. Hashem said, Vayihi, and everything that's in creation became and is. That's 1/7 of your life. So let's ask the question there. Why is it so difficult? Isn't it obvious? If you don't want to disbelieve, if you don't have an agenda to deny it, it's so clear, it's so obvious. What do we need Shabbos for? What do we need so many mitzvahs surrounding emunah? It should be a no-brainer. And to answer this question, I want to focus on something very, very interesting. When my wife was about 6 or 7 years old, her mother was expecting. And one day, my wife said to her mother, Mommy, what happens if you give birth to a cat? And her mother said, what do you mean? She said, I don't know, what if Hashem makes it that you give birth to a cat? And her mother looked at her and said something like, well, listen, you know, mommy elephants give birth to baby elephants. Cows give birth to baby cows. Cats give birth to kittens. Mommies give birth to human babies. That's just the way Hashem made the world, and that's the way it is. And still my wife pressed and said, but what if? What if Hashem makes it? What if Hashem makes it that you give birth to a cat? And what my wife was expressing was something that many children at a tender age sort of feel, like they're very fanciful, they're very imaginative, and what if? Why not this and why not that? And what if Dumbo had big ears and really could fly, and why not? And the imagination of a child is very, very expressive and very creative. And whether you've asked that particular question as a child or not, most children do ask or do dream the following dream. What's it like on Lollipop Farm? Right? The vivid imagination of the child easily allows them to see Lollipop Farm. What's Lollipop Farm? Lollipop Farm is where gumdrops grow on bushes and lollipops grow on trees and licorice grows like roots in the ground. And when the child envisions that candy land, that lollipop farm, the mature adult says to the child, please, Mashallah, understand. There's no such thing as Lollipop Farm. You have to understand the candy has a recipe. So much sugar, so much flavoring, and someone has to decide what the recipe is. Someone has to mix it, and someone has to put it all together. It's not just there, but even more. Let's even say lollipops grew on trees, as you say. Let's just say gumdrops really grew on bushes. Don't you understand? There need to. It all comes from something. There are no elves bringing in stuff. You need elves to, I don't know, go. They'd have to have plantations, and they'd have to cut down the sugar cane, and they'd have to distill it and refine it, and they'd have to ship it over by train, and you'd have to have all kinds of villages of trains moving, and all kinds of. You'd have to have a whole army of elves to keep these lollipop farms going. And there's no such thing as elves, Mashallah, and therefore get real. And that's what the mature, reasonable adult says to the fanciful, imaginative child. And I'd like to share with you that while the adult sounds very grounded and very real, actually the child is a little bit more accurate. And let me explain to you what I mean. The next time you are in an orange orchard, imagine you're standing in a beautiful orchard, hundreds of trees laden with oranges. Beautiful, lush oranges. You take one off the tree and you peel and you get that mist, the aroma, and you break open the wedges and you bite in and you get a burst of flavor, citrusy, tangy, sweet, delicious. I have three questions that I'd like to ask my local atheist. And if you can find me an atheist who can answer these three questions, I will tip my hat to him. Question number one is as follows. Where did the stuff of the tree come from? Right? Remember, every tree begins with a seed. You put the seed in the ground, and eventually up comes the stem. Eventually it forms bark, and eventually it grows into a big, big tree that weighs thousands of pounds. Now, the seed weighs, I don't know, a tenth of an ounce. Where did all the stuff of the tree, the cellulose, the bark, the twigs, and eventually the thick trunk, where did the substance that makes up the tree come from? And so naturally to say it comes from the ground, right? Well, not so fast. You see, if you were to take a metal vat, a large metal vat, and put 500 pounds of dirt into that metal vat, take an orange seed, put it into that dirt, leave that vat in the sun for 10 years, you'd come back and find a fully formed orange tree, laden with orange, but still 500 pounds of dirt in that metal vat. You see, the stuff of the tree, the substance, does not come from the ground. The stuff of the tree comes about through a process called photosynthesis. What is photosynthesis? The leaves are the green color that properly absorb the maximum amount of the sunlight. And they mix together a little bit of carbon dioxide, a little bit of water, and they synthesize. That means make a new object. If you'd like to know where the thousands of pounds of substance that makes up the tree come from, the leaves synthesize it. They take the sunlight, take the water, take the carbon dioxide, and they make a new object. The leaves make the substance of the tree. Now, that is a pretty impressive little process. But let's get to question number two. Question number two to ask your local atheist is as follows. When you bite into that orange, you get that delicious, citrusy, tangy, sweet flavor. Where did the sweetness of the orange come from? Now, remember, it all starts from a little seed in the ground. Now, if you've ever bitten into an orange seed, you'll note that it's rather bitter. The water is largely tasteless. You ever hear the expression, I'm going to make you eat dirt, boy? Well, I've never eaten dirt, but it's my belief that dirt is largely bitter. See, here's the question. If the seed is bitter, the water is tasteless, and the dirt is either tasteless or bitter, where does the sweetness of the orange come from? And the answer, of course, is some basic science, and that's something called photosynthesis. That means to say the leaves absorb the sunlight, mix in some water, a little bit of carbon dioxide, and they synthesize that flavor. Now, folks, there are no elves. Mix in a little bit of citrusy. Come on, a little bit of tang. Come on, we need a little bit more flavor. Oh, it's a little too bitey. We need a little sugar in here. The leaves on their own, somehow it is, know how to make that delicious, citrusy, tangy, sweet taste. Now, that is a pretty impressive thing because I don't know if you've ever given an an IQ test to a leaf. Sir, who's the president of the United States? Do you know where you are? Do you know what time of day? A leaf doesn't have an IQ. A leaf is an inanimate object. Well, it's growing, I guess, on some level. But there's such wisdom that it functions with that it's able to photosynthesize, create anew the substance of the tree, create the substance of the orange. It's able to form the glue to keep the orange attached to the twig as it's growing. It's able to form the beautiful orange fully formed. But there's one more step. Let's get to question number three. What color is the orange? Now, that's not really the question because the orange is orange color. But question number three I'd like to ask my local atheist is as follows. Where did the orange color come from? The seed on the outside is white, on the inside is kind of gray. The water is kind of basically colorless. The dirt is kind of brown. And if you were to dig down all the way to China, you would not find orange pigmentation. Where did the orange color of the orange come from? And the answer again is photosynthesis. The leaves absorb the sunlight. They mix with the water and the carbon dioxide, and they synthesize that color. Now, folks, do you know how to create the color orange? It's not only red and yellow. You need to mix in some blues and some greens to get the right exact hue. You know what the PMS match color of it is? Well, don't worry about it. Whether you do or you do not, your local leaf does. And if you begin thinking about this single concept, you should be filled with a sense of awe. This is astonishing. The complexity to be able to form oranges, to be able to form apples, which are very different, that are crunchy, and to be able to form bananas that are beautiful yellow on the outside with a peel that opens up only when it's ripe. Try opening a banana before the banana is ripe, and you'll find you can't even break it open. But the glue begins releasing. It begins opening up a little bit. The peel has been created as such that it's perfectly ready to be opened only when the banana is ripe, only when the sugars are at the right point, only when it's fully formed and it's in its most delicious state. And when you recognize that there are no elves, no teams of elves with the formulas, yet there's celery and there are potatoes, there are radishes and there are strawberries. There's an entire array. Go into your grocery store and see the wonder that comes from the ground without anyone supervising. If you owned a business that produced objects on its own, if you owned a business that made computers, but no one had to manufacture anything, just made them on their own, made cars, made clothing on its own, you'd be a very, very wealthy fellow. We don't own such factories, but the ground produces things of astonishing complexity. Walk in the end of the summer through a cornfield, 6 feet tall, and you'll see these husks all the way up. And when you open the husk, what you find is a beautiful, perfectly nutritious type of food contained in the right exact format, the right color, the right flavor, ready for you. And when you begin studying this, you should be filled with a sense of astonishment and wonder. But that's just the beginning. Let's go one step further. The water, the carbon dioxide, the energy, all of it has to come somewhere. Even on Lollipop Farm, you needed elves to bring in the sugar. You need, where does all the stuff come from to the orchard? Now, the carbon dioxide really isn't much of a question because that's an obvious one. Now, the leaves aren't just bakers and they're not just color mavens. The leaves of your average tree also happen to be chemists. And they know just how to synthesize carbon dioxide, which is a necessary ingredient. They'll use some up. They'll put some out. Very interesting sort of things these leaves are. But the carbon dioxide isn't such a question. Where does the water come from? It's a little bit more complex because, you see, most trees aren't growing by the side of a lake. Most trees don't have ready sources of water. So where does the water come from? So let's focus on one interesting point. Planet Earth is covered on the surface of it by 70% water. 70% of the surface of the Earth is covered with water. So obviously there's plenty of water to go around. Obviously we don't have any question. There should never be such a thing called drought or anything of the like. Unfortunately, though, 90% of that water actually is contained in the oceans, and only about 3% of all the water on the planet is actually fresh water that humans can drink, that animals can drink, that can be used to for crops and trees and etc. But it also happens to be that 3/4 of that fresh water is frozen at the polar caps. So of all the water that exists, only about 1% of it is actually fresh water that you and I can drink, that animals can live on, and that can allow the species in general and plants to exist. Now, here's where things get really, really difficult to understand, because that 1% of the water usually is nowhere near the farm. If we only farmed along the edges of lakes and rivers, well, maybe I guess we'd understand where the water comes from. But that's not really the way life works. The reason why it's not the way life works is because there's a very interesting transport system for water. You see, water can exist in 3 states. Water can be a solid, water can be a liquid, and water can exist as a vaporous gas. Well, it just so happens that a very interesting phenomenon occurs. The huge, huge oceans are bombarded by sunlight. And because they're bombarded by sunlight, the water contained in the ocean begins evaporating. Water can exist as a gas. And the sunlight converts into energy and begins causing the water to evaporate. But when the water evaporates, it's only the pure water that leaves. The sediments, the salt-containing minerals, are left behind. So the water that evaporates is pure, distilled water. And as it floats up into the sky, it is just pure water. As it gets higher and higher, it gets cooler, and it begins condensing. You have clouds. Clouds are formed because it gets cooler, and the vapors now sort of join together. They condense. And interesting enough, there is in this world something called winds. Now, winds are one of the great mysteries of modern science. Are they caused by the sun and the moon and the polar shifts? It's very, very difficult to get a straight answer to exactly how. But somehow it is that these winds are there, and these winds carry the clouds. So imagine you have this huge Pacific Ocean, and it happens to be that it's constantly, the sun is hitting it constantly, water's evaporating, causing these clouds. The winds come and carry these clouds away. Well, it just also happens to be that there are certain mountain peaks at certain points. The mountain peaks cause these clouds to go even higher. When they go higher, they get more and more condensed. They get thicker and thicker until they form rain clouds. Then it just so happens to be that those rain clouds are conveniently brought to places where they're needed, and it just so happens to be conveniently that it rains exactly where it's needed. That is a very, very sophisticated transport system, because a cloud can weigh thousands of tons. A cloud contains so much water that in a 20-minute downpour, you could find 125 million gallons hitting a very small area. But despite the fact that it weighs millions of pounds, it's brought across the sky because it's in that vapor state, and it's brought right to where it is, and the water is transported. But if you're not yet moved, let's take one more step over here. If you've ever been on a country road, a dirt country road in the summer, and it begins pouring, what you notice is there are puddles all over the place. The road becomes muddy, becomes very difficult to walk because there are puddles wherever you go. Now, here's the question. If these rain clouds are very, very dense and they drop millions of gallons of water, why doesn't the water, wherever it is, just puddle up and never get to the roots? The roots of a tree could be 25, 30 feet, 50 feet down in the ground. Why doesn't all of the water just drop on the surface and cause puddles and little lakes and become useless for the plants, the trees that need it? The answer to that question is answered by our friend Charles Darwin. The famous father of evolution made an estimate. He looked at the amount of sheep that could graze on an acre of land, and he weighed them, and he approximated that if you take the weight of the amount of sheep that could graze on an acre, they would weigh about as much as the aphids and the earthworms in the ground underneath them. You see, any field that you will walk on has underneath it armies and armies, colonies of earthworms and aphids, insects that eat through the ground all day long. If you take a kitchen sponge and it's dry, it's very light, but you put it under the tap and it gets filled with water and very heavy. The way a sponge works is it contains micro tunnels, thousands and thousands of tiny little tunnels. The water enters those tunnels and it fills the entire sponge, because the sponge is actually all these micro tunnels. The dirt that you walk on, the fields that you walk on, is as porous as a sponge. And because these aphids, these earthworms, these various insects all day long are tunneling and tunneling. So it's not just you have a water cycle that transports the water. You have a very, very sophisticated army of insects that create this porous surface, that create this porous field, so that when it rains, the water enters the top of the ground and it gently filters through these tunnels, these billions and billions, countless tunnels, and it gently, gently filters down all the way down and down, fills up the water table, and there's water there for the trees, for the crops, for everything needed. And that is rather complex and rather astonishing. And let's take one more step. Because if our tree needs carbon dioxide and that it gets from wherever it gets, and if it needs water and we know the water cycle and the transport system of the wind and the aphids and the earthworms, what about the energy? There has to be a source of energy. There has to be something that's powering this tremendous factory called this orange tree. So as you know, the sun provides the heat, the light, the fuels, almost everything in existence here. The complex chemical chains of life are fueled by the sun. But here's a very interesting thing to think about. The sun is some 91 million miles away up there in the sky. And anywhere between here and there is pretty cold. A jet plane that flies at 35,000 feet is warm inside because they heat up the inside. But at 35,000 feet, it's about negative 50 degrees. It's freezing cold. It's the Arctic up there. Why? Because you see, the sunlight that transfers through space doesn't give off very much energy at all. You see, the sunlight passes through countless miles and miles of space, and it's pitch black out there. Because when it's traveling, it does not give off any light, and it does not give off any heat. It's only when it hits the surface of the Earth that it's instantly transformed into heat or energy or whatever it's going to be transformed into. But the entire pathway that it was traveling, it was in a different form. It traveled as light, and only when it hit the surface of the Earth did it give off the energy. So light traveling at 186 million miles a second, hurtling through space at unimaginable speeds, remains pure until it gets to the place where it's supposed to be energy. It turns into a different state. It turns into light. It turns into heat at that point. And at that moment, you should say the words, Marabu Masech Hashem. This is astonishing beyond belief. And this orange tree is converting this sunlight. And the most sophisticated transport system, 186 million miles a second from 91 million miles away. And it brings in the energy. The leaves have the wisdom somehow to take the water that's brought there miraculously, and take the carbon dioxide, take the energy, and make this orange. And any human being who looks at an orange tree should fall on his face and say, this is so astonishing, it makes Lollipop Farm look like child's play. It is way more sophisticated than lollipops growing on trees, than gumdrops forming on bushes, than licorice roots growing in the ground. It's real food, celery and cucumbers, tomatoes, and radishes, with all of the flavors, with all of the enhancements, growing from the ground, with a transport system bringing the ingredients, with sophisticated factories producing it without anyone supervising. And any human being who studies that should fall on his face and say, this is astonishing, Hashem Hu Elokim. And yet we don't. Why? Because that's nature. Of course. Apples grow on trees, and cucumbers grow on the ground, and radishes grow. That's just the way it is. And don't get bent out of shape. Don't go playing the God card over here. That's just the way it is. And if you'd like to understand what Rashi's telling us, that's exactly, I believe, what he's saying. You see, the Jewish nation had lived with this Be'er, with this rock, for 38 years. Day after day, week after week, they witnessed this rock spewing forth billions of gallons of water. That became natural to them. That was a given. When Miriam died, the water stopped. The rock went to hide. Moshe Rabbeinu was sent to bring it back out. When Moshe Rabbeinu hit the rock, it was the old rock trick. We know that one. Yeah, that's the rock that spews forth the water. It's not a big deal. The wonder, the wow was lost. Why? Because they had seen it day after day after day. To us, it would have been so miraculous, so astonishingly fantastic, we probably couldn't even believe it. But because they had seen it day after day, week after week, it lost its impact, it lost its meaning. And Hashem said to Moshe, had you spoken to the rock, that would have been something new. And that would have been something they didn't see before. And that would have been something so novel that they would have gotten it. They would have said, oh my goodness, it's a nace. If the rock listens to Hashem, so do we. But you lost your opportunity, Hashem says to Moshe. Why? Because you used the system of hitting. They saw the rock before. It didn't move them. It was only if you had spoken to him, and unfortunately, your moment has been lost. And I believe that this Rashi shares with us a phenomenal concept. Number one, in terms of emunah alone, technical information doubles every 2 years. The human civilization is pumping out so many new devices, application, uses of scientific knowledge that every 2 years, it doubles the amount of technical information that was there. I've heard it said that professors will tell their medical students their first year, in the next 4 years, you're going to learn a tremendous amount of information. And in 2 years, 50% of it will be obsolete, will no longer be applicable. The problem is we don't know which 50% that is. But the reality is that science is uncovering phenomena and tremendous things that mankind can never envision. And in that sense, we live in wondrous times. And the fact that we're not truly, truly moved by it is because it's rugged, we're accustomed to it, and we have to train ourselves to envision and see the wonder of it. But I believe what this Rashi is really sharing with us is something that cuts even deeper and further. It's not just a chiddush in emunah, it's something that touches on everything we do. Chazal use a concept called hakaras hatov. Hakaras hatov means recognizing the good. You see, the reason why science doesn't move us, the reason why an apple tree, an orange tree doesn't move us is because we fail to recognize the wonder of it. It is, it was, it will be. That's the way of nature. And the reason we're not so moved by it is because we're used to it. And because we're used to it, we're accustomed to it, it becomes something that's rote, it becomes something that's just meaningless, and we cease to recognize the good. And Chazal tells us that Hakaras HaTov, recognizing the good, is a character trait, is a midah, but it's not just emunah, it cuts across all of our relationships and many, many of our situations in life. As a high school Rebbe, I spent much of my time trying to teach the fellows in my shir. Obviously, you try to teach them atosis, that's a big part. How to learn is a big part of a Rebbe's job. But I felt that a Rebbe's job is also teach these fellows how to live and teach them about life. And I spent many, many hours with each class telling them about this concept of Hakaras HaTov. And oftentimes I would speak about parents, how much you owe your parents, how all that you are is because of your parents. They didn't just bring you into the world, they fed you and clothed you. The fact that you know how to read Aleph Beis, the fact that you know how to hold a knife and fork. It's all because you had a mother and father who helped you, who taught you. And oftentimes I would go on and on and on. One day I spent 45 minutes explaining to these guys that everything that you are is because of your parents. The amount of money they spent on your clothing, on your bed, on your schooling, on your camp, on everything for your good. And after a long 45-minute routine, I took a break, and one of the fellas came over to me and said, Rebbe, I hear my parents bought everything for me and did everything for me, but why do I owe them anything? That's their job. Once they decided to have me, they have to take care of me. That's their job. Why do I owe them anything? And I wanted to grab this guy by the shirt collars. Because yes, it's true that that's their job. When you bring a child into the world, you have certain obligations to that child. But you are the recipient of that good. Your parents' job is their job, but you're the one who's receiving all of that good, all of that love, all of that attention. And the reason why you don't feel it is because you don't even see it. You don't even recognize the good It's expected. You're entitled to it. And you don't even recognize it as a good. And this seems to be a very human trait. We are all very, very grateful. We're extremely grateful if anyone would do anything for me. But my parents don't do things for me. My children don't do things for me. My spouse doesn't do anything for me. Because everything that happens is just there. I'm entitled to it. It just is. And what we lack is recognition. We lack hakara satov. It's not that we're not appreciative in the sense that we're not grateful. We're very grateful, but we're not appreciative because we don't see it. I don't see the good. I don't see what's done for me. Hence, of course, I don't feel any sense of gratitude because no one has ever done anything for me. And if you would like to grow in emuna, obviously you have to grow in hakara, in recognizing, looking at this world and seeing its vastness, seeing its complexity, looking at the systems and saying it's astonishing. You open a science textbook, and you open a Tuesday New York Times, and you see the science section, you see the complex systems that are so beyond description. A simple cell in the human body is more complex than New York City. And you begin studying it, and you begin to recognize it, and obviously you grow in emunah. But the point that you're also doing is coming to understand what recognition does. Instead of being asleep, instead of being just going through the motions, you begin recognizing things. And you train yourself in this midah, in this trait of recognizing. You recognize the wonders of this world. And you train yourself in this trait, and you recognize the wonders of what people do for you. Young people and old people, friends and people aren't such friends. And you have a tremendous sense of gratitude because you begin understanding the riches of your life and what you're given. And if you don't work on this midah, if you don't work on this understanding of recognizing things, you will have a very bitter, ugly life. And I'll share with you an example. We live close to our Sameach, and we try to have the fellows over regularly. Oftentimes, the guys become bnei bias, and we have a lot of conversations, certainly at the Shabbos table and certainly other times, with the fellows as they become balei tshuva, as they become frumah, etc. There was one fellow who once said to me as follows. He said, as I was learning more about Judaism, I had a question, and I asked this question to anyone I could speak to. Anyone I could ask, I asked this question to, and I could never find an answer. I asked it to college professors, I asked it to rabbis. I couldn't find an answer to this question. What was this question? This question is, why have kids? Why would you have children? Why would you do it? But don't get me wrong. He wasn't asking, why have children, because then I have to worry about these little brats. He wasn't asking, why have children, because then I have to spend all my money that I could be using otherwise. Uh-uh. He was asking much deeper than that. Why have children when this world is so ugly? Why bring children into such a difficult thing called life? Because you want to have a child? Why would you do that to an innocent, sweet kid just because you want to have a child? Why would you subject that child to this misery, all the pain and hardship that exist in life? And this question he asked and he asked, and he could not find an answer to. Now, let me share with you the wrong answer to the question. The wrong answer to this question is, you're right, life is very harsh, very difficult. But, you know, Hashem is good, and Hashem created the world to come, and you'll go through tremendous pain here, and you'll have tremendous, tremendous sorrow, and it's a rough, rough life, but it'll be worth it in the end, because in the end, you'll gain Olam Haba, and Olam Haba, the world to come, is so great that it's worth it. Now, that answer is 100% true, obviously, but it's a wrong answer to his question. Why? Because the correct answer to his question is, look at this world. There are wonders, there are enjoyments, there are enhancements. A person should wake up in the morning with a sense of joy and happiness. My goodness, I'm alive. I could grow. I could accomplish. And there's such pleasures to be had in this world. Granted, there are rough spots. Granted, there's work. Granted, there are many things. But it's a beautiful world. Look at a sunrise. Look at an ocean. Look out at the beauty of this world. You'll see so many things that Hashem put there simply for us to enjoy. And a person should feel such hana, such pleasure, such enjoyment in this world. And if you don't, it's only because you don't understand life. If you live a life in a vacuum, if you have no meaning, if you have no purpose, if you wake up in the morning and just whatever, there's going to be an underlying depression, and nothing in life is going to bring you any joy, And you cannot look at a sunrise and say, wow. You can't bite into an apple and say, that's delicious, because there's a pervasive ugh within you. But when you understand life, when you live a life of meaning and purpose, when you understand why Hashem put us on this planet, you're here to grow, to accomplish, you wake up in the morning with a sense of empowerment, let's go. And there's a love of life, and with that love of life, you take in all of life. Yes, life has its moments. Sometimes there's pain, and there's difficulty, and not everything is sugar-coated. But the reality is there's so many pleasures, and a human being should be so happy. And especially a Jew who's growing and accomplishing should feel such a sense of fulfillment. There's joy, there's happiness. The pervasive feeling, the climate of his existence should be joy, happiness, and his life should be very, very grand. But you see, this is the point. This young man lived in the same world as you and I, but he saw ugliness. He saw pain. Is there pain in the world? There sure is. Are there things that shouldn't be? There sure are. But the reality is, if a person's living his life appropriately, the climate of his existence should be joy, and he should be able to take in everything. Yes, I see pain, and yes, I see sorrow, but I also see such beauty, and I see such wonder, and I have such pleasures from the things in this world. But if you don't train yourself, you won't see it. And if you go about this life, as many people do, as automatons, robots going through the motions, they never stop to smell a flower. They never stop to watch a sunrise. They don't pay attention to music, and they don't pay attention to the food that they eat, and they go through the motions of life like a robot. And guess what? Their life truly does stink. Because if you work and you work and you work and you work and you're busy and busy and busy and busy, life really is very burdensome. But it's not the way Hashem created us to be. And it's not what Hashem wants. Hashem wants us to enjoy life. It's not the purpose of our existence. We're here to grow, to accomplish. We're here for the world to come. But there are so many enhancements that Hashem put into this world. So many flavors and aromas and textures and sights and beauty that Hashem created strictly for us to enjoy. But to enjoy it, you have to train yourself to recognize it. And much like you have to train yourself to recognize Hashem in the Bria, you have to train yourself to recognize that there's a system that was created by a brilliant, wise creator. And you have to train yourself to recognize the good that you receive from people. You have to train yourself to recognize the good in the world. But it's one mida, it's one trait. Hakara, recognizing. And training myself to recognize the good. What Rashi is sharing with us is a phenomenal concept. The Jewish people were on a very high level in the Midbar. But every day of their existence, they had lived with this rock spewing forth billions of gallons. And they traveled many times, and the rock traveled with them. They were used to the bushes and the trees growing on the side of the tributaries. It meant very little to them because they'd seen it day after day. When the rock stopped putting forth the water, Hashem said, Moshe, speak to it. And that change is something that's going to awaken the people. And they'll see something novel, they'll see something new, and that will change their reality. But for some very slight, almost ununderstandable mistake that Moshe Rabbeinu made, because he did speak to the rock, but there was somewhere deep down a slight error, and because of that, when he hit the rock twice and it spewed forth water, Hashem said to him, your mistake has caused a terrible error to be brought into the Jewish nation, and that is they've lost their lesson. And they're going to look at it as it was before, and they're going to say, this is nature, we've always seen it, and the great lesson they could have learned, they're not going to learn. They're not going to say, look at that, a rock listened to the words. If a rock listens, so do we. They've lost that lesson and they've gone back. And to us, the chiddush, the novel point should be that you could live with a be'er, with such a miracle, and not see it. And if we wonder, how could it be? The answer is right in front of our eyes, because we live with such tremendous miracles that don't just rival the rock, that far exceed it and superpass it many, many times over. And that orange tree produces, and there are no elves, and there's no transport system, yet the energy is brought there. The sun produces enough energy to constantly keep everything there. The water is constantly brought by the clouds, by the evaporation system, by the condensation. The aphids and the earthworms are there. And the leaves somehow have the intelligence to produce the substance and the sweetness and the color. And when you study this world, you see far more than a rock spewing forth water. You see miracles of astonishing proportion. Why don't we see it? Because we don't train ourselves. We have to stop. We have to study. We have to think. We have to train ourselves to recognize the good. When we do, we see a world replete with wonder, constant new concepts and new ideas. And we say the words, my goodness, if this is the creation, what does it say about my creator? And every day we see novel, new things of unimaginable proportions. And when we train ourselves in this midah, we also recognize the good that people do for us. We recognize the favors and the help. And whether they intend it or not, I am the recipient of so much good. I walk in a land that's secure. There are firemen and policemen, emergency medical technicians. I live in a land of law and order. I am the recipient of so much good from so many people. There are policemen who will give their life. They'll take a bullet for you or I, and you'll say that's their job. Whether it's their job or not their job, I have to recognize the good that I receive. There are men in uniform who protect these shores. In the United States of America, there's a military, there's an air force, there's an army. I am the recipient of so much good, and I have to recognize it. And when I train myself in recognizing it, I live a life of tremendous wealth. And when I train myself to recognize the good, I see the wonders around me. And not only do I see the hand of Hashem, but I enjoy these things because I recognize them from what they are. And I want to close with one last thought. When my daughter was in seminary, she went on the Holocaust tour towards the end of the year, where they take the girls to Poland and they take them through the areas where the Jews were. They take them to the concentration camps. They show them what life was and what became of our people. And it's a very, very interesting trip and very worthwhile. But one part my daughter told me about that I found very interesting. She was in a seminary. It was pretty large. And they went with a number of buses through with all the girls through Poland. But in front of the buses was a truck with six pods, six, you know, porta-johns, you know, these portable restrooms. And I was curious, why have a truck with the six porta-johns in front of the buses? And the answer is because they were going through miles and miles and miles of Poland where there were no restrooms. So anytime they had a rest stop, they'd have to, the girls would get off the bus and use these porta-johns because that was the only rest stop in the area. And I said to myself, that's astonishing. Our people lived in Poland for 800 years. The Second World War ended in 1945, 70-odd years ago. And there are parts of Poland today that are as primitive, as backwards as it was 2,000 years ago. We go on any highway, wherever we go, and there's a restroom. And the only question is, do they have Starbucks? Can you drink the coffee? Can't you? But there are parts of the world. We're talking huge, huge sections where restrooms don't exist. And if you want to tour it, you bring your own porta-johnny because what we accept as normal living isn't there. And if you think about this fact, it's astonishing. We live a life of such luxuries, indoor plumbing. We have heating. We have air conditioning. We have carpets. We have straight walls. The average taxpaying citizen today enjoys luxuries that kings of yesteryear couldn't imagine. So why aren't we all rich? Why don't we feel it? And the answer is really simple, because we don't recognize it. I don't see it. I don't sense it. So I might as well not have it. I'm poor. And by growing in this midah, by learning to recognize, what happens is I see Hashem as the creator. I see what people do for me. I see the wonders of my life. I enjoy it and I feel a sense of wealth. Look what I have, the pleasures, the flavors, the aromas. Look at the food I eat. Look at the bed I sleep in. It's astonishing. And when you train yourself in this midah and you grow in so many ways, it's the cornerstone of emunah. It's a cornerstone of relationships. Certainly it's a cornerstone of real gratitude. And when a person works on this, it affects so many different areas. May Hashem grant us the wisdom and ability to put this into practice. The Shmuz was written and recorded L'Zeicha Nishmas Reb Yosef Ben Arav Naftali Shimon HaKoin, a young man who left us at the age of 32, a beacon of chesed, a pillar of true greatness, a man who lived very few years but left the world tremendously inspired. It's incredibly difficult to sum up a great human being's life in but a few words,
but as an example of the Hakaras HaTov that Rabbi Yossi had, of his emuna based on that, of the recognition of Hashem and teaching the world that he exemplified in his existence, one story is illustrative. When he was sick towards the end of his life, he was constantly aware of people who did things for him and constantly saying thank you. One of the doctors from Einstein who came to the Shiva house said that the nurses would say that if he says thank you one more time, I'm going to break down crying. And one of Rabbi Yossi's friends said about him that when he was in the hospital and it was close to the very end of his life, and it was very close when he was being leave, a nurse came to help him deal with whatever needed to be done, and it was very clear that he was in extreme pain, and very clear that he asked for the medication to be given exactly in the right time, in the right way. And after saying exactly what he wanted, he then began saying thank you to the nurse. But it was like he became a different person. Instead of the pain, instead of the fatigue, he was filled with an energy, and he began thanking the nurse. And the nurse said, it's okay, it's okay. He said, no, no, no. I want you to appreciate how much it is that I recognize what you've done for me. And he began thanking her and thanking her. And he reiterated it, and he said again and again. And if you would see the energy that he exhibited at that moment, if you would recognize it, you would see almost a man transformed. This shmooze, recognizing the good, and that being a central core, was something that Rabbi Yosef exhibited in his life. May this be a Ili Nishmas. May we be Zocha to learn from him.